In 1941, the U.S. government was concerned about diplomatic inroads that Nazi Germany was making in Latin America. So the State Department looked to Hollywood for a counteroffensive. Specifically, they looked to Walt Disney. It is a little-known initiative, and it's now the subject of a new documentary called Walt and El Grupo. Here's our critic, Bob Mondello.
You'd think the Disney studio would have been riding high in 1941. Snow White and Pinocchio had been huge hits. Dumbo and Bambi were in pre-production. But world affairs were cramping Walt Disney's style, especially a war in Europe that was drying up foreign markets and capital.
The whole world was collapsing then. And so I just practically stopped my feature production. That's all I could do. Then is when I had the strike.
An animator's strike at the house the mouse built left the filmmaker seriously depressed, so when the Roosevelt administration came calling, urging him to make a goodwill tour of Latin America, he was eager to get away. Not eager to just shake a lot of hands, though, so he got the government to send his top animators with him and made it a working tour. The idea was to research future films by soaking up the sights and sounds of Latin America, and soak they did. Filmmaker Ted Thomas is the son of Disney animator Frank Thomas, who made the trip, so he had access to a motherload of documentary material, letters the animators wrote home, sketchbooks they filled, and photos of them filling them, staring at, say, a live parrot as they created their cigar-smoking animated parrot, Joe Carioca.
Donald, I will show you the land of the samba.
Samba? What samba?
Ah, the samba.
The rhythms captured on this trip were as much a revelation to the Disney group, El Grupo, as they called themselves, as the colorful foliage and animals were. This was an era when international travel was not yet common, and in 16mm home movies from the trip, you can see the excitement as 1940s cities burst into gaudy state welcomes for the creator of El Ratón Mickey. The State Department evidently got it right. More than a decade before Walt Disney became a familiar face on TV, the huge crowds suggest that this goodwill tour actually generated goodwill. And the documentary doesn't settle for showing that. It mixes in new footage, so the image can fade from a sketch of Donald Duck sitting on a balcony with a mountain in the background to a shot that is clearly that same balcony today with Rio's Sugarloaf Mountain in the background. The filmmakers even found some of the folks who performed for Disney, including an ancient, almost toothless dancer who narrates footage of his 20-year-old self stomping and twirling with Disney all those years ago. He and Disney couldn't understand each other, he says, but Disney seemed happy. In his later life, Walt Disney would get a rep as a control freak with a dark side, but on this trip he was not yet 40, still willing to wear a gaucho costume and twirl a lasso, just as Goofy would in a cartoon that emerged from the trip. The Oscar-nominated movies Saludos Amigos and Three Caballeros were the immediate result, filled with stereotypes, yes, but comparatively friendly ones. The State Department was pushing a good neighbor policy, remember? And in return for a guarantee, in case the films didn't earn their money back at the box office, which they did, by the way, Walt and El Grupo were happy to promote the idea that it's a small world, after all. I'm Bob Mondello.
You can see clips from the film at npr.org.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
And the goal of many people concerned about climate change is to find alternative sources of fuel to generate electricity. That's because scientists say more than one-third of the world's carbon dioxide emissions come from burning coal. One possible alternative fuel is also one of the oldest, wood. From member station KSMU in Springfield, Missouri, Jennifer Moore reports on a process aimed at more easily converting wood into fuel for coal-burning plants.
Right now, I'm at the James River Power Station, and looming over my shoulder are four enormous smokestacks. I'm surrounded by rather large hills of black coal. Now, this coal is obviously burned to provide energy for the city, but the reason why we're here today has to do with a much smaller pile of what looks like dark sawdust. This is torrefied wood.
I'm going to burn some of the torrefied wood we made in a plant in Missouri for a test. It will blend, or it can be fired to 100% of the fuel rates.
That's Andrew Livingston, president of the Kansas-based EarthCare Products. His company engineers biomass energy products like torrefied wood. Torrefaction, also known as biochar, is a process of roasting wood chips in a large furnace to remove the moisture and make the product more brittle. Coal and wood both give off carbon dioxide when they're burned, but the trees originally got their carbon from the atmosphere as they grew, so burning wood doesn't put new carbon dioxide into the air. Livingston is here in Springfield, Missouri with his team to test whether local provider City Utilities can mix a 10% blend of the wood with 90% coal and get good results. Employees here flip a switch and the pile of torrefied wood begins to disappear through an unseen trap door under the pile, making its way into the plant on a conveyor belt. Inside the plant, control room operators are keeping an eye on the monitors to make sure the test is running smoothly. Steve Myers is the director of the James River Power Station.
We have a lot of hardwoods, and we have a lot of trees that need to be cleaned up. We have a lot of wood chips out there that need to be cleaned up initially.
While many environmentalists see some benefit to burning wood instead of coal, they also have reservations about where that wood might come from. Terrence Bensel is a professor of environmental science at Allegheny College in Meadville, Pennsylvania.
Anytime you have a situation where you have trees being cut on a significant scale directly for power plant use for combustion in a power plant, you do run the risk of some ecological impacts in that forest.
But he probably won't have to worry about that happening anytime soon. Chris Hopkins is a researcher at North Carolina State University who produces torrefied wood on a small scale. He says large coal-burning facilities are still reluctant to sign on to the idea without seeing solid results from much larger test burns.
It's just unknown as to whether you can produce machinery at that scale for a reasonable amount. You know, you don't know what the technical hurdles may be as you scale up.
So that's what today's test is all about. And utility officials here say the data is still being analyzed. But they like the idea of burning larger quantities of torrefied wood, as well as other biomass products like switchgrass, to fuel the power station. And in doing so, they hope to take a small step toward weaning the hundreds of coal-burning power plants in America off of the one fuel they currently rely on. For NPR News, I'm Jennifer Moore in Springfield, Missouri.
Now let's take a closer look at what the president proposed. NPR's Julie Robner has been covering the story for years and was listening last night. She's been helping us all this year keep our facts straight. Good morning, Julie.
Good morning, Steve.
What changed last night, if anything?
Well, you know, until now, we've been talking about the president's plan this, the president's plan that, but there really wasn't a president's plan. There were all of these plans floating around on Capitol Hill. There rather purposely wasn't a president's plan. President Obama had left all the details to Congress. He'd given them sort of a page of guidelines. And this, I think, was an effort for there to become a president's plan. Now, what he laid out was similar to what a lot of the Democrats in Congress have been doing, but not identical. I think there was also a big shift in emphasis. Until now, there'd been a lot of talk about really how to help people who didn't have insurance, and not too much on really looking at those people, the 160, 180 million people who have insurance. Really, what's in it for me? So let's listen.
They will no longer be able to place some arbitrary cap on the amount of coverage you can receive in a given year or in a lifetime. We will place a limit on how much you can be charged for out-of-pocket expenses, because in the United States of America, no one should go broke because they get sick.
So changes in the rules for insurance, that's what's on offer for those with insurance. What about those without insurance?
Well, very much like most of the plans that are floating around in Congress, the president is promoting something called health insurance exchanges. These are marketplaces where individuals and small businesses could go to buy insurance. Here's how the president explained it last night.
If you lose your job or you change your job, you'll be able to get coverage. If you strike out on your own and start a small business, you'll be able to get coverage. We'll do this by creating a new insurance exchange. a marketplace where individuals and small businesses will be able to shop for health insurance at competitive prices.
And for individuals and small businesses who can't afford the cost, there'll be subsidies and tax credits. And that's, of course, what accounts for most of this bill's big price tag.
Hundreds of billions of dollars over a decade.
Indeed.
And we should note that under the president's plan, as laid out last night, if you don't have insurance right now, you're going to be required to get it.
Yes, in most cases, there are some hardship exemptions. That's a flip-flop from his primary campaign. He was actually the only Democrat who did not endorse that. But that's what they do in Massachusetts, so that's a big piece of this.
Massachusetts, one of the states that's got something like universal health coverage or something close to that. Why would the president change on that?
Well, in fact, it was made finally clear to him that the system really doesn't work unless everyone is in it. It's really the only way to cover everyone is if everybody has insurance. It's what they call shared responsibility.
Julie Rovner, the president said he was embracing some Republican ideas, trying to take this very partisan issue right now and trying to position himself as being bipartisan. Is he embracing Republican ideas?
A few. He did make sort of a nod in the direction of doing something about medical malpractice lawsuits and defensive medicine, endorsing some demonstration projects. There were a couple of Republicans that said that's a nice thing. He didn't go very far in that direction. He talked about Senator John McCain's idea to have high risk pools for people who couldn't get insurance, that might be an interim step while they're waiting for these pre-existing condition exclusions to come into effect 4 years from now if this were to become law.
So a little bit there, not too much. And the president actually got booed at one point by Republicans when he said that illegal immigrants would not be covered under his plan. Let's listen.
There are also those who claim that our reform efforts would ensure illegal immigrants. This, too, is false. The reforms I'm proposing would not apply to those who are here illegally.
Now, amid all that booing, you can hear Representative Joe Wilson of South Carolina shout out, "You lie." There's been a lot of coverage of the etiquette of this. Wilson has apologized, but let's ask about the substance. Was the president truthful in saying that his plan is not going to cover illegal immigrants?
Yes, the president was truthful in saying the plan does not give benefits to illegal immigrants. The Republicans are complaining that there are loopholes in the plan that would let illegal immigrants get benefits anyway. This is because the Democrats have rescinded some rules that were so onerous that it was preventing citizens from actually getting benefits.
And just very briefly, in a few seconds, is it clear now that the president is going to be able to extend coverage to millions of people, which costs a lot of money, and still save money in a healthcare system that he says is spending too much money?
That's the hard part. Congress is still working on it. It's going to take several more months to see if that can be figured out.
Julie, thanks very much.
You're very welcome.
NPR's Julie Rovner in our studios this morning.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Alyssa Block.
And I'm Robert Siegel. The U.S. poverty rate hit its highest level in 11 years in 2008. That's according to new numbers released today by the Census Bureau. The census counted almost 40 million people living in poverty in what was the first year of the recession. NPR's Pam Fester reports.
The fact that poverty's on the rise is no surprise. With the start of the recession back in December 2007, unemployment has been going up and incomes going down. The median income dropped 3.6% last year, and the poverty rate rose to 13.2%. That pushed an additional 2.5 million people below the poverty line. Many were children. David Johnson, a senior statistician with the Census Bureau, said the increase is clearly linked to jobs.
Children in non-working families, children in female-headed households, children in families that receive food stamps, their poverty rate didn't change much, whereas children in earner households, the poverty was affected a lot. So you see a lot of it tied to the earnings change in 2007-2008.
Which makes a lot of people nervous. If things were so bad last year, what about now?
These numbers are grim, grimmer than we'd expected.
Robert Greenstein heads the Liberal Center for Budget and Policy Priorities. He knows that joblessness has only continued to rise.
This creates a very serious concern that if we already were at just under 40 million Americans in poverty in 2008, before the biggest increases in unemployment, poverty is going to go much higher than that in 2009 and 2010.
In fact, he predicts it could go higher than it's been in 50 years. The view from Ron Haskins of the Brookings Institution isn't much brighter. He's a Republican who was instrumental in the welfare overhaul of the 1990s. Haskins thinks that today's numbers show the country's in the midst of an extended period of bad news.
We're in an era, I think, of several years of fairly serious poverty levels, and especially if you compare it with the late 1990s, because that was a wonderful time for poverty. Way more people worked, in part because of welfare reform.
He says the problem now is that the jobs just aren't there, and the prospects for future job growth aren't good. Haskins notes that almost all segments of the population have been affected, except the elderly, who didn't experience a significant increase in poverty last year.
All over the country, married couple families, middle class, low income, single parent families, except the elderly, poverty increased for almost every group. So it's a very widespread phenomenon.
Although the poverty rate did remain unchanged for blacks, Johnson of the Census Bureau said it's not clear why, but he noted that blacks already had a very high poverty rate, almost 25% last year, compared with 8.6% for non-Hispanic whites. Poverty among Hispanics rose by 2 percentage points to more than 23%. There has been some criticism recently of how the government measures poverty, and Johnson said the Census Bureau will be producing some alternative statistics later this year. He said, for example, if food stamps are factored into the poverty numbers, more than 2 million fewer people would be considered poor. But Haskins says, by any measure, poverty is on the rise. And of course, that's not news to people on the front lines. George Jones runs Bread for the City in Washington, D.C., a nonprofit that provides food, clothing, and other services to the poor. He says the lines there keep getting longer and longer.
When the economy really started to sort of falter, we were seeing an uptick of about 10% increase of food clients over the course of a 12-month period. So 2 consecutive years, we saw that level of growth.
And it's been the same across the country. What has Jones concerned now is that he's only beginning to see the next wave of the newly poor. Pam Fessler, NPR News, Washington.
And today's last word in business is shovel ready. If you think government stimulus money has been slow to reach communities in the United States, consider some villagers in northeast India. Residents outside a provincial capital have been waiting 20 years for the government to build a critical road to the main city. Villagers say they need the road to get vegetables and rice to markets before they rot. The government has blamed a lack of funds ever since the project was announced in 1989. And this week, villagers finally got fed up. The French news agency AFP tells us that about 750 men and women have taken up spades and axes and are building the road themselves. And instead of 20 years and counting, they plan to finish in 25 days. That's the business news on Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm Renee Montaigne.
From NPR News, it's All Things Considered. I'm Robert Siegel.
And I'm Melissa Block. This is back to school week throughout much of California, and parents and teachers aren't quite sure what to expect. The summer was filled with massive budget cuts. In Los Angeles, those cuts were especially severe. As NPR's Carrie Kahn reports, district officials fear the worst is yet to come.
At the 99th Avenue Elementary School in Watts, Sandra Gonzalez walks her two sons to their new classrooms. 10-year-old Isaac is starting fifth grade and 7-year-old Moises is in second. Gonzalez is excited, but also worried about all the budget cuts.
I'm really sad about it because more kids who are teachers and they're not going to have the time for the students.
This year, elementary schools throughout the sprawling Los Angeles school district will have 24 students per classroom. Some high schools will have as many as 43 in a class. The district had to close a $1.6 billion deficit. Hundreds of teachers were let go and nearly 2,000 others were rehired, but only as substitutes. At 99th Avenue Elementary, the welcoming assembly for parents and teachers was as upbeat as possible, even though not all the staff had come back.
We're adjusting. You know, you have to do what you have to.
Principal Sherry Williams is defiantly upbeat. She's had to make do without 4 full-time teachers and has had to cut hours from other support staff. William says she's trimmed everywhere so she can keep both the school nurse and psychologist.
And hope the nurse can counsel and the psychologist can put a Band-Aid on.
District officials say if you think the classes are overcrowded and the teachers are scarce now, the next 2 years will be even worse. Federal stimulus money will have run out, and state lawmakers left the district with a current deficit of $140 million. A fix is working its way through the legislature, but if it doesn't come through soon, officials say they will be forced to make more cuts before the end of the year. And teachers' union officials are threatening court action over a resolution signed by the school board to turn over as many as 200 schools to nonprofits and charter organizations.
We see that as privatization of public education.
Teachers' union president A.J. Duffy says if the current administrators can't run the schools, they should be fired. As it is, he says they're being allowed to give away the ship to the highest bidder. But despite all the financial and legal challenges ahead, district officials tried to put their best face forward during the first week of school.
I don't know that LA has ever started the year with enough money in my lifetime.
Board President Monica Garcia met with a group of teachers at a brand new high school in Boyle Heights. It's the first high school built in this part of East LA in more than 80 years. She says times are tough, but the cuts are forcing the district to make better use of its resources and to work harder.
LAUSD is moving away from the culture of complacency and excuses into the culture of performance, urgency, and working together, because that's what our kids need.
But with a dropout rate still hovering at 50% and student funding now one of the lowest in the nation, Los Angeles school kids have a rough year ahead of them. Carrie Kahn, NPR News.